Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and in the early hours of Friday, September the 27th, these are our main stories. The most senior Democrat in the US House of Representatives accuses Donald Trump of trying to cover up details of a phone call he made to the president of Ukraine. The sparks keep flying as British MPs ponder how to tackle the toxic atmosphere in Parliament. And the dangers lurking in a harmless-looking cup of tea. Also in this podcast,
bacteria can use this sneaky mechanism to hide. Then, after the antibiotic treatment is gone, they put the jackets back on.
Why bacteria are stripping off to survive. It was time for President Trump to hit caps lock again. Our country is at stake, was the Twitter warning. Republicans should stick together in the face of the Democrats' move towards his impeachment, he said. And when he gave his reaction to the unfolding developments on Capitol Hill, there were no holds barred.
It's a disgrace to our country. It's another witch hunt. Here we go again. It's Adam Schiff and his crew making up stories and sitting there like pious, whatever you want to call them. It's just a disgrace. It's a terrible thing for our country. They can't do any work. They're frozen, the Democrats. They're going to lose the election. They know it. That's why they're doing it. And it should never be allowed, what's happened to this president.
Thursday was shaping up to be a significant day in the Democrats' attempts to hold the president to account over the 9-page whistleblower complaint about his behaviour. Most of it was published for us all to see. And Congress men and women of the House Intelligence Committee got to cross-examine the USA's most senior intelligence official about the case. As the hearing got underway, the committee chairman, the Democrat Adam Schiff, said the partial transcript of Mr. Trump's July phone call with the Ukrainian president showed the US president pressuring his counterpart to dig dirt on the Democratic presidential hopeful, Joe Biden.
Yesterday, we were presented with the most graphic evidence yet that the president of the United States has betrayed his oath of office, betrayed his oath to defend our national security, and betrayed his oath to defend our Constitution. For yesterday, we were presented with a record of a call between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine in which the President, our President, sacrificed our national security and our Constitution for his personal political benefit.
Much of the back and forth, at least as far as the Democrats were concerned, centered on how long it took for the whistleblower's memo of concern to reach the House Intelligence Committee. Had Mr. Maguire, they wanted to know, sat on the complaint, perhaps at the behest of the White House? This is part of what he had to say to that.
I appreciate that in the past, whistleblower complaints may have been provided to Congress, regardless of whether they were deemed credible or satisfied the urgent concern requirement. However, I am not familiar with any prior instances where a whistleblower complaint touched on such complicated and sensitive issues, including executive privilege. I believe that this matter is unprecedented.
Nick Bryant has been following developments for us in Washington.
I think what was interesting was the evidence that the whistleblower presents of a potential cover-up, that the transcript of the call was stored not in the computer system normally used for such information, but rather a separate system used for classified information of an especially sensitive nature. An especially sensitive nature would normally relate to national security, but the whistleblower was suggesting that this was politically sensitive, and that's why it had been stored in a different part of the computer system. Now, the call itself was incriminating. No explicit quid pro quo, but often, Tim, as you know, it's the cover-up that gets you in Washington, and the Democrats are suggesting here's the evidence of a cover-up.
And is the other thing that they're producing in evidence of that, that Mr. Maguire, the acting director of national intelligence, didn't bring this memo of urgent concern to them immediately, as all precedent suggested he should or would?
I don't think they went as strongly as that as perhaps they would have. with a different National Intelligence Director, because Joseph McGuire is a former Navy SEAL. He's obviously a sort of all-American hero. He's a pretty straight-up guy. So they didn't really try to present him as somebody who was doing the president's dirty work here. I mean, he's a very credible individual, and they didn't single him out. But they believe that even without that delay in delivering this whistleblower report, there's evidence in the transcript that Donald Trump was seeking help from a foreign country to interfere in a presidential election. And they believe that the whistleblower account also shows that there was a cover-up as well at the White House. Of course, the Republicans reject this, and how you regard the whistleblower report is largely determined by how you regard the president. The Democrats obviously see this as fueling their impeachment inquiry. At the moment, and this is the crucial thing, most of the Republicans are on board. And the key sign to look for is if any Republicans defect, because if they don't, it'll be impossible to remove the president in an impeachment process.
Nick Bryant talking there to Tim Franks. Thursday witnessed another febrile day in the British Parliament. The Speaker, John Bercow, implored MPs on all sides to tackle what he called a toxic political culture and to treat each other as opponents and not enemies. The daughter of one high-profile MP said she is scared every single day for her mother's safety because of the vitriol surrounding political debate. Ellie Cooper, whose mother is the Labour MP Yvette Cooper, urged politicians to moderate their language. She tweeted that she's terrified something awful like the murder of the MP Joe Cox could happen again. But Boris Johnson is refusing to apologise for his language after he was accused of inflaming divisions. On Wednesday night, he'd used words like surrender and betrayal during a heated debate in the House of Commons, at one point dismissing the dangers of inflammatory language as humbug. But on Thursday afternoon, speaking to the BBC, the Prime Minister called on all politicians to stop what he called personalised and abusive remarks in order to make progress.
Tempers need to calm down and people need to come together, because it's only by getting Brexit done that you'll actually lance the boil, as it were, of the current anxiety.
As ever, our political correspondent Rob Watson has been following all the latest twists and turns.
I don't think there's any doubt that this is a low point in British politics since the drama of the referendum in 2016, and that a line has been crossed in behaviour. But of course, Mark, given how polarised we are in the UK, you tend to have that sentiment much more amongst people who voted Remain and who voted Leave. But I just leave you with the words of Nicola Soames, the grandson of Winston Churchill, and a former Conservative MP, who said that he was absolutely appalled by the language and tone of the House of Commons. He is a very popular and highly respected MP.
And this has, of course, been a week of lots of firsts. But Rob, have you ever known a governing party, as happened today, struggle to pause Parliament to hold their regular annual party conference?
No, I mean, it is utterly unprecedented. But again, it is a mark of the complete breakdown of what is the usual way of doing business in this country. I mean, I have never heard before of a Prime Minister describing the ruling of the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, as wrong. So we are in that land of firsts.
And Brexit is still dominating everything. So opposition parties have put measures in place to stop the UK leaving without a deal. Now, do the government now accept that?
I think the kindest thing to say about the government's position is that it's contradictory, because ministers saying on the one hand that of course they will respect the law, but on the other hand they're also saying that with or without a deal, the UK will leave the European Union on the 31st of October, even though Parliament has passed law saying there can be no departure without a deal. And I do actually think, Mark, that one of the key questions in British politics over the next few days and weeks is the government really serious about breaking the law to leave the European Union? And is Parliament, can MPs really stop them if they wanted to do that?
Rob Watson. The lights dimmed on the Eiffel Tower on Thursday evening to mark the passing of France's former president Jacques Chirac, who's died at the age of 86. There have been warm tributes from world leaders, past and present, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Another former French president, François Hollande, said, "I know that today the French people, whatever their convictions, have lost a friend." There will be a national day of mourning on Monday. On Thursday, France's parliament held a minute's silence to remember Mr. Chirac, as our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson reports.
Nous venons d'apprendre le décès de Monsieur Jacques Chirac.
For a minute today, France's political arguments ceased.
Une minute de silence.
as MPs paid their respects to a leader one described as a man of great affection and great humanity. Jacques Chirac became president in 1995 after two stints as prime minister and almost two decades as mayor of Paris. His down-to-earth charm unleashed on everyone, from French children to German chancellors. During 12 years in power, he failed to heal France's social divisions as he'd wanted, instead creating new international divisions by refusing to join the US and Britain in the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a stance that won him strong support at home.
L'Irak ne représente pas aujourd'hui.
Iraq today does not represent an immediate threat that would justify an immediate resort to war. France calls upon everyone to preserve the unity of the Security Council.
Que la légalité internationale soit respectée.
He also won support for being the first president to publicly recognise France's role in the wartime deportation of Jews. Dark hours, which soil our history forever, he said. Chirac won a second-term landslide in a runoff against the far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen, during which left-wing voters were urged to hold their nose and vote for the crook rather than the fascist. His later years were dogged by ill health and a conviction for embezzlement during his time as Paris mayor. But personal and political failings never dampened the affection for Jacques Chirac, nicknamed the bulldozer, the weather vane, satirised as the super liar. He remained perhaps France's favourite leader, a president with a very human nature, a very human touch.
Lucy Williamson. 66 migrants who are stranded in camps in Libya have arrived in Rwanda, the first to be relocated following an agreement between the Rwandan government, the UN Refugee Agency, and the African Union. The migrants had become trapped in Libya while trying to reach Europe. Anne Soy reports.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says many of the evacuees are unaccompanied minors and vulnerable people. They are among about 4,700 migrants and asylum seekers who have been stuck in detention centres in Libya. The UN says the centres are unfit to house people and detainees have reported being subjected to torture. Rwanda offered to host 500 of the migrants, but it is not known how long they will stay there and what rights the country will accord them.
The cult fitness startup Peloton has begun selling shares on the US market. The company, which sells high-end stationary bikes equipped with screens to stream classes on demand, has attracted more than 500,000 subscribers. But the bike comes with a pretty hefty price tag, and Peloton as a company has yet to make a profit. The BBC's business correspondent Samira Hussain went to see what the hype was all about.
All right, we're in this together, Peloton. 3, 2, rise with me.
That kind of motivational sound is a signature feature of Peloton.
In 3, 2, 1, push.
These stationary bikes are unique because of the live stream and on-demand classes, allowing the user to virtually ride with thousands of others.
3, 2, back it up to 105.
They've only been on the market 5 years, but already have developed a cult-like following.
Oh, yeah. I am the cult. We're all the cult.
That's Joanna Sim. She's been riding a Peloton for over a year and absolutely loves it.
You don't find many lukewarm Peloton owners, at least I haven't seen. You either thrive or you kind of don't get it, and very few people don't get it. And that's because of the tribes.
Tribes? Yes, tribes. They are groups of like-minded Peloton enthusiasts. For example, there's a Peloton Law Moms, or the Peloton Cigar Smokers and Whiskey Drinkers, if that's more your speed.
My number one recommendation to all my friends who get a bike is join a tribe and find friends, because you just do so much more as a group.
Keep it up, Peloton!
Over 500,000 people have bought a Peloton, but translating that popularity to success on the stock market is a different game. Peloton has not yet made a profit. The bike is pricey, $2,000 plus an additional monthly subscription fee for its classes. To eventually make money, Peloton may need to convince some traditional spin enthusiasts to ditch the class.
Three, two, one, taking up to the mic,
I'm at my indoor cycling or spin studio in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm crashing an evening class to ask some of the riders if they'd ever make the switch to a Peloton.
Would you ever consider getting a Peloton bike?
Probably not. One of the big things is the cost is super expensive, and also I really enjoy working out with people.
I've thought about it, but I don't think so. I really think there's something to be said for coming here, engaging with people in the community, and it really is always just kind of like a nice start to my day, and I think it would be a little isolating maybe to have a Peloton bike.
Okay, but what does that mean for the company's success on the stock market? I put that question to Rhett Wallace, the CEO of Triton Research.
How successful the company will be in the long term is a different matter because we just don't know how big the market for $2,500 exercise bikes is. So for example, if we were going to look at Apple, Apple needs to bring out new hardware in the form of iPhones and MacBooks and other things like that from time to time to sort of refresh its hardware revenue, but also to re-engage its users. We'll see if Peloton is able to do the same thing.
Let's be better than we were yesterday.
After floating on the exchange, Peloton will face a long ride to profit.
Samira Hussain reporting. Still to come on this edition of the Global News Podcast, Britain's official poet marks the naming of the country's latest polar research ship with his thoughts on the impact of climate change. Scientists have caught bacteria using a new way of escaping antibiotics in order to survive. Essentially, they get naked. The team at Newcastle University say bacteria's ability to strip off their outer layer could explain why some infections keep coming back. More details from James Gallagher.
Researchers at Newcastle University filmed bacteria undressing and taking off their outer layer. It's called a cell wall and gives a bacterium shape and protection. But it's also a weak spot that is exploited by many drugs. The original antibiotic, penicillin, disrupts the cell wall to make bacteria burst. The study, published in Nature Communications, looked at bacteria taken from elderly patients with urinary tract infections that just kept coming back. The team spotted that some bacteria were responding to antibiotics by slipping out of their cell wall in order to escape the drug's effects. One of the researchers, Kasia Mitskayevich, thinks this could explain why some people struggle to get rid of an infection.
It could mean that bacteria can use this really clever, sneaky mechanism to hide from antibiotics. And then after the antibiotic treatment is gone, they put the jackets back on and then they start to replicate and they cause full-blown infection again.
Losing the cell wall is a risky move that makes bacteria more vulnerable. But patients with a weak immune system, such as the elderly, may struggle to get rid of them. Experts say more research is needed to confirm exactly what is happening inside patients' bodies, but the findings could lead to new ideas for tackling bacterial infections, such as using combinations of drugs that attack both the cell wall and the inner workings of bacteria.
That was James Gallagher. Now, as you sit back and listen to the rest of this podcast, how about pouring yourself a cuppa? You won't be alone if you do. It's the most widely consumed beverage in the world next to water. But be careful what you choose after another warning about the use of plastic, this time in tea bags. According to scientists, our traditional cup of tea could be at risk of contamination. The research was carried out by a team from Canada's McGill University, led by Professor Natalie Tufenji. But first, what exactly are plastic tea bags?
The tea bags that we suspected would be plastic are the ones that have a pyramid shape. They also have a silky look and feel to them. They are sold in different countries across the globe, but we really don't know how common the product is.
And what happens? There are tiny plastic bits in these tea bags, and how quickly do they get into the water?
In fact, what we think is happening is that the actual fabric of the tea bag, the actual mesh, is starting to slowly break down in the hot water. This is what we suspect. Our study didn't really look at the process of the tea bag breaking down. We were just curious to know if after a short 5-minute steeping period in 95 Celsius water, whether the tea bags would actually release some plastic particles.
Okay, so within 5 minutes, you've got plastic bits in your water. How harmful is that for humans?
We actually don't know if it is harmful at all. At this stage, all that we do know is that the tea bag releases billions of tiny plastic particles into a single cup of tea. Just to give you a point of comparison, a typical cup of tea steeped with the plastic tea bag will contain about 16 micrograms of plastic. Now, the next highest level that's been reported in the scientific literature is in table salt. And in table salt, it's been reported that it might contain about 0.005 micrograms per gram of salt. So the number of particles is really quite impressive. So far, what we've done is just a very preliminary study. We've exposed water fleas to these particles that were released from the tea bags. And the water fleas didn't die, but their behavior was affected. So they started becoming very stressed out. They started swimming very erratically. They also had some developmental malformations. So clearly, the particles were having an impact on these water fleas, but it really remains to be shown whether this could be potentially dangerous for our health, though. What we're hoping is that people will reconsider the use of these tea bags just because they are, at the end of the day, another single-use plastic that is unnecessary and that will end up in a landfill or the environment somewhere. You know, there are alternative ways, of course, to drink tea with paper tea bags or with loose-leaf tea in a metal steeper.
Professor Natalie Tufenji of McGill University. A court in Portugal has found a British couple in their 70s guilty of smuggling drugs onto a luxury cruise liner. They were trying to take more than $2 million worth of cocaine into Europe from the Caribbean. Here's Damien Grammaticus.
As the Portuguese judge sentenced them to 8 years, Roger Clark, shaken, turned to his wife and said, "We'll be 80 when we get out." Sue Clark began crying. The pensioners were being watched by police because, in their 70s, they were living way beyond their means, taking regular, expensive cruises despite having a modest income, and they had a history of drug smuggling. 15 years ago, when their names were Roger and Sue Button, they served prison time after trying to smuggle 240 kilograms of cannabis resin into Norway, hidden in their car. This time, the cocaine was hidden in the lining of suitcases.
Music has been shown to help calm dementia patients, make them feel happy, and even bring back memories, according to several scientific studies. Someone who knows all about the power of song is the musician Nile Rodgers, the man behind the disco band Chic. 13 years ago, his mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Our reporter Zoe Conway spoke to him.
Let it rain, let it pour.
Tell me about the effect that Alzheimer's has had on your mother.
Prior to her being moved to the facility that she lives in now, which they call a memory care residence, she was having a pretty difficult time. For example, she was driving erratically, and my little brother said, "Hey, Mom, can you pull over?" She got really angry and just stopped the car in the middle of the freeway, and the cars are traveling at 100 miles, and they're flying.
Pitter pattered all the raindrops on my window pane.
Alzheimer's is a very strange disease where sometimes you're in this very small world and you don't understand what's going on around you.
Did you stumble upon this idea that music was a way to reach her? How did that happen?
See, not really. I had a very good idea. Every one of my mom's siblings, including her mother and including her mother's sister, all had Alzheimer's.
Mm.
I mean, talk about it running in families. So the experience that I had with my mom's sister was incredible because we used to sing Beatles songs to her for about 4 or 5 years. She lay in a coma, but when we sang Beatles songs to her, she would come out of the coma and sing along with us. And as soon as we'd stop singing, she'd go back into a sort of vegetative state. My mother's situation, this phenomenon of her having perfect pitch and singing along with every single song that she knows is amazing. She sings perfectly in tune. And my mom was never a singer. We were visiting a mall And every time we passed a different store, they were playing, a different musical program. And my mom knew every song. It was hysterical to me. And then finally we passed one, and it was playing a Johnny Mathis song. And my mom started singing almost at the top of her lungs. And people thought that she was some kind of entertainer. They all applauded, and she felt like $1 million.
It seems that you have found a huge amount of joy when you're with your mother. Without that music, do you think you would have found so much joy?
I don't think that I could even imagine without the music, because it's so much a part of who she is. It's so much a part of who I am. We'd be going out of our way to not do what's natural to us.
That was Zoe Conway speaking to the musician Nile Rodgers, with a little bit of help from Johnny Mathis at the end there. Finally, amid all the growing global concern about the changing climate and its impact on the future of life on planet Earth, the UK held a ceremony on Thursday to name its new polar research ship. Prince William's wife, the Duchess of Cambridge, did the honours, naming it the Sir David Attenborough, after the famous BBC broadcaster and naturalist. But for Britain's official poet, the poet laureate Simon Armitage, the occasion also provided a moment for reflection on the changing world and seas that the new ship will encounter. This is his poem, Ark.
They sent out a dove. It wobbled home, wings slicked in a rainbow of oil, a sprig of tinsel snagged in its beak, a yard of fishing line binding its feet. Bring back the leaf. They sent out an Arctic fox. It plodded the bays of the northern fringe in muddy socks and a nylon cape. Bring back the leaf. Bring back the reed and the reef. Set the ice sheet back on its frozen plinth. Tuck the restless watercourse into its bed. Sit the glacier down on its highland throne. Put the snow cap back on the mountain peak. Let the northern lights be the northern lights, not the alien glow over Glasgow or Leeds. A camel capsized in a tropical flood. Caimans dozed in Antarctic lakes. Polymers rolled in the sturgeon's blood. Hippos wandered the housing estates. Bring back the leaf. Bring back the tusk and the horn unshorn. Bring back the fern, the fish, the frond and the fowl, the golden toad and the pygmy owl. Revisit the scene where swallowtails fly through acres of unexhausted sky. They sent out a boat. Go, little breaker. Splinter the pack ice and floes. Nose through the rafts and pads of wrappers and bottles and nurdles and cans. The bergs and atolls and islands and states of plastic bags and microbeads and the forests of smoke. Bring back the leaf. Bring back the river and sea.
Simon Armitage reading his poem Ark. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.